Remember the Canadian Navy's role in World War II? The country had just two aircraft carriers. One, the Nabob, was destroyed by a German torpedo. This hour, we'll talk to an Iowan who was aboard when the ship exploded. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. Dr. Charles Reed, now 93 and a retired University of Iowa medical professor, survived the destruction of the Nabob and went on in 1951 to devise the diet that diabetics still use today. We'll hear about Reed's service as a doctor in the Canadian Navy. We'll start the hour, though, with a conversation with a recent graduate of the University of Iowa College of Public Health, Carmen Smith, who will tell us about her experience in Gambia fighting the eye disease trachoma. But first, the news. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese, filling in today for Charity Nebbe. Colleges of public health are not especially common in the United States. The University of Iowa College, established in 1999, recently moved into a new $48 million facility overlooking the campus. The college says its mission is to promote health and prevent injury and illness through commitment to education and training, excellence in research, innovation and policy development, and devotion to public health practice. The College of Public Health announced it was starting a new student ambassador program to put a face on the college. Carmen Smith knew she wanted to be a part of it. Smith has just finished a Ph.D. in biostatistics. The 25-year-old from St. Louis has traveled to Gambia to do research on a devastating eye disease called trachoma. I recently talked to Smith, whose focus is statistical genetics, or genome-wide association studies. There's not a lot of colleges of public health in the country, right? So Iowa has, one of the few, is that right?
Yeah, I don't know how many, but it's less than 100, I would say.
And maybe people don't really quite understand what a College of Public Health is all about. I mean, what goes on there?
Well, so our college has five departments. It is the Department of Biostatistics, the Department of Epidemiology, Health Policy and Management, Occupational and Environmental Health. Usually it's composed of different departments similar to those, and it's housed generally within a college. Usually they aren't, I don't know of any that are separate from a university, but we are all studying public health and playing our different parts, you know, because I'm more on the analytical side and like environmental health, but all for the same focus of the countries and even global health.
And your field is biostatistics?
Yes.
Yeah. So, well, that sounds pretty technical. That sounds really, really technical. So you've had a math background?
I have. Yes, but it's not required, especially here. They kind of assume that everyone comes in on the same slate. I knew that I wanted to do biostatistics, so when I was in undergrad, I was preparing for that. But it's really just the analytical science of public health, data collection, data analysis, designing studies and things like that, how to do that.
What sort of things have you been exploring?
Oh, man. So I've done a lot of different things, which is interesting. I've done some HIV research. I've done some cancer research looking at like tumor growth. Right now, I'm focusing on statistical genetics, which is what I really love, how to look at DNA and to figure out which genes are interacting, how they're interacting with the environment, with your diet, and things like that is where I'm interested in going in the future. At this point, I'm working with studies called genome-wide association studies, which is basically scanning the genome of a sample of people and trying to link disease to a causative gene.
So. Uh-huh. And what sort of diseases are you looking at? You mentioned AIDS, but
Right now I'm not looking at any particular diseases. I'm looking more at the study design and how to analyze the studies, but I'm interested in its effect on your diet and more preventative care than actual disease causation, but along.
Well, this is sort of the cutting edge research now.
Yeah,
genetics,
it is.
Right?
It really is.
And
yeah.
In fact, if we conquer diseases, I'm reading that it's going to be because of genetics.
I think so.
Genome.
I'd like to think so. I hope so.
And you've got a long career ahead of you, and I'm sure many amazing things will happen. It's got to be exciting.
It's really exciting. And especially now because I'm coming towards the end. I've been here for 4 years now, so it's really getting to the time where I'm looking at job prospects and things like that to really try to find where I'm going to fit in as a professional.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've spent time in Gambia.
Oh, yes.
in Africa and doing research through the Minority Health and Health Disparities International Research Training Program.
Yes.
Tell me about that and the sorts of things you did.
Oh, man, that was an amazing experience. So as you said, it was a part of the MERT program. I did it two summers ago, and it was really interesting because I was able to see how research is done in another place. It was really the first time I had been away from an academic institution. So I was at the Medical Research Council, which is a British institution. It's kind of analogous to the National Institutes of Health here in the United States. And I was working with the statistician there, and I was just kind of helping him on projects that he already had underway, working with, they had a data entry, an actual data entry facility there. So they had people that were going out into the field and collecting data. He had a PhD student that he was working with that had gone out and collected data on a disease called trachoma. It's an eye disease, and it's actually the number one infectious cause of blindness in the world. So it basically causes your eyelids to invert and your eyelashes, like, scratch your cornea. It's really a nasty disease. But that was what I spent most of my time trying to find different cellular links to the disease and how it affected your cells.
So how many people in Gambia, which, of course, is in West Africa, suffer from trachoma?
I don't know exactly how many, but I was able to go out into the fields when they went to collect samples from some of the villages where people were suffering from it. And it's really, it was pretty prevalent. And one of the main ways that they treat the disease is by removing your eyelashes. So I met a lot of people that actually already had the corrective surgery. So it's pretty prevalent. It's spread by, like, flies and by mucous membranes, but it affects a lot of children too. So.
And so does it result in blindness at some point?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, so then after this surgery, which sounds like it's not major surgery.
No, not.
And then people are okay.
Yeah.
But of course, the idea is to prevent this from happening
exactly.
in the first place.
Exactly.
And so what you're saying is by studying genetics that may result in a cure at some point?
But it could.
Yeah.
It could. But I think that it's totally preventable already. They already know how to prevent it, but it's more access to preventive medicines that was really the problem.
Oh, so. I see. Preventive medicine. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you like it in Gambia?
I loved it. It was amazing. It was one of the best experiences.
How did the people react to you as a U.S.
Oh, they
student,
loved me.
researcher.
Yeah, they loved me. I got to go out into the villages. I spent a lot of time just walking through markets, and the beach was literally across the street from where I was staying, so I went there a lot, and I got to meet a lot of people, and it was awesome. I think because it was an off season, it's actually a research destination where I was. Because it was off season, everyone was really laid back, and they were willing to take me wherever I wanted to go. They were really, really gracious people.
Why did you choose public health rather than, let's say, going into medicine?
Actually, I was between those two points for a while, but I think that I was always research minded rather than interested in actually practicing medicine. So when I figured out that I didn't have to be an MD in order to do health research, public health was just a really good fit for me.
If I could just ask you to predict the future, this is such an exciting field you're in. I mean, what do you see happening in the years ahead?
I think that I really see a lot of growth in many different areas. I think that in general, as a country, especially with all of this business about healthcare reform and stuff, people are really looking more in how can I keep myself healthy rather than once I'm sick, what can I do to make myself better? So I think that is where the country will be moving within the next 10 or 15 years. So I really hope to be a part of that because I think that a lot of illnesses really are preventable. So looking more into how to stay and be healthy. I know Michelle Obama has been doing this, like, get fit thing and things like that to where we can be healthy in general rather than trying to fix something after it's broken.
Carmen, when you were in Gambia, you mentioned the disease trachoma, which is fairly widespread there, and I'm sure they have other health concerns in that country, as they do everywhere in the world. Looking at your experience in West Africa versus health issues here in the United States, What are your concerns about how healthy we are here in the U.S. today?
I really think I know cancer research is a really huge part of the amount of research that we do here in the States. The National Cancer Institute is the largest cancer institute, I think, in the world, if not the second largest. But I think my major concern in my own life and in my family's life is really diet, how people eat, whether we eat a lot of fast food or not, making sure that you're getting enough fiber, enough green things in your diet and things like that. I think that that's really one of my major health concerns. And I think that if people were to focus more on that, it would really change a lot.
And does this relate to the obesity epidemic there?
Yeah, everybody
is
absolutely
talking about it today.
I really think because a lot of people think about exercise, and exercise is great and it really does help. But another large part of it is really your diet. It's a combination of the two that makes you healthy overall. So.
And why don't people take better care of themselves?
Because it's hard to do sometimes, and it can be expensive, too. I know I suffer from that sometimes, being on a graduate student budget. But it's easier sometimes to kind of just go with the flow and go with what everyone else is doing rather than making a conscious effort to change your diet. But once you get into it, I think I've read several times before, it takes, 21 days to create a habit. So if people just took the little bit of time to change their mindsets, I think it would help a lot.
What are your fellow students saying about wellness? Young people, are they concerned about these health issues? Are they concerned about obesity? I mean, the university has put up this incredibly wonderful wellness building that students have access to. And many, many students and even the general public use the building. But what are your fellow students' concerns about this?
No, I think Iowa is kind of one of the more conscious places that I've been. It seems like a lot of people here really do think about those things. I know in my group of friends alone, we're starting a step team as a part of my sorority this summer. And one of the major reasons that we're doing it is not just for the fun, but also just to get in shape and to make it a team effort, you know, rather than an individual effort. So I think, you go around Iowa City, you see people running and biking all the time. The rec center is always, you know, making it a team effort helps. I know I talk to my mom and she tells me about the things that she does to stay healthy and she keeps exercising and things. So I think maybe having a unit around you that has the same focus so that you can motivate and push each other is helpful.
Carmen, I wish you well. This is very interesting, and congratulations
on
your studies. Wish you well on your future.
Awesome. Thanks.
Carmen Smith just completed a PhD degree in biostatistics from the University of Iowa College of Public Health. Coming up, looking back on a medical career that started on Canada's only aircraft carrier, destroyed by a German torpedo in World War II. 93-year-old emeritus professor of pediatrics, Professor Charles Reed's new memoir is called This Navy Doctor Came Ashore. Talk of Iowa continues after this break. It's Talk of Iowa. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe. Dr. Charles Reed has been a doctor for a very long time. The retired University of Iowa professor of pediatrics grew up in Amherst, Nova Scotia. He's 93 now and has published a memoir about his service in the Royal Canadian Navy in World War II. It's called This Navy Doctor Came Ashore. After he finished his medical practice and joined the Navy, he spent 3 weeks in Charlottetown, where he relieved the medical officer of the HMSC Queen Charlotte. It was actually a land ship that was moored. It turned out that a great deal of his time was spent writing prescriptions for alcohol so that the officers could be allowed to drink. But his Navy service became a bit more interesting when he was assigned to the aircraft carrier NABOB, one of only two Canadian aircraft carriers. The NABOB was destroyed by a German torpedo in 1944 when Reed was on board. 21 men were killed, and Reed went back to the mainland to continue his work as a Navy doctor, even though a lot of his time was spent helping civilians on Prince Edward Island. Dr. Reed went on to have an illustrious medical career, almost all of it spent in Iowa City. I talked to Dr. Reed recently about his memoir and asked him how the Canadian response to World War II varied from the American.
Oh, it was quite different. And for instance, in both the Navy and the Air Force in Canada, everybody was a volunteer. There was conscription for Army, but only for service at home. those that went overseas in the Canadian Army were all volunteers.
Did the Canadian forces fight separately from U.S. forces?
Well, on D-Day, the Canadian 3rd Division was one of the divisions that went in that day. But they were not very close together, but it was a very close association between the American and Canadian forces. And we were very, very good friends. When billeted side by side, as I remember one time, two divisions were, and they had a great time together. They didn't get along so well with the British, though.
Oh, really? Why not?
I don't know. I think it's because the British tended to look upon us as still as colonials, even though we've been independent since 1867.
Uh-huh, yeah. Well, anyway, in 1943, you were 24. So why did you decide to go ahead and join the Canadian Navy rather than starting your practice, your medical practice somewhere?
Well, during my years in college, when I graduated, undergraduate in 39, during those years, I read Mein Kampf. I'd watch Hitler go step by step through all the things he said he was going to do, and I realized that he and the Nazi movement were a tremendous threat to the Canadian way of life, as it was for the American way of life. On the day war was declared, I committed myself to being involved in that war. The question was then, was I do it now, or was I going to go to medical school first? It so happened that I'd been accepted to medical school at McGill University in Montreal, and it was to start the next day. So I had a day of debating what was I going to do. But the next day I went to first class, and Dr. Penfield, a famous neurosurgeon, talked to us, and he said, this war is going to last a long time, and you can make a much greater contribution to the war effort as a doctor than you would in one of the services. So I continued medical school.
There was probably a great need for physicians in the armed services.
Well, there was, particularly as the services all grew. For example, the Navy grew from 2,400 to 2,500 men and officers in 1939 to 100,000 in 1944. Yeah.
Well, take us back to 1943. You decide to enlist, and why did you choose the Navy?
Well, I grew up in Nova Scotia, surrounded by the sea. One part of it.
Yeah, it was in your blood, sort of.
Well,
yeah.
Sort of. And but one of the advantages was I had notions of joining the Air Force, but I found out that oftentimes those doctors were sent to someplace in middle Western Canada and fought the war there, or they got to UK and were there for indefinite periods. Whereas the Navy had a rotation. Every 6 months you moved to a different thing, including 6 months of a refresher time every 2 years.
Well, tell us the story of your first few weeks as a medical doctor serving in the Canadian Navy. What happened in those first couple of weeks or so in 1943?
Well, in December of it was I joined on the 1st of December of 1943.
Uh-huh.
And nothing really significant happened until I'm for a month. One time I heard that we were going to have our first Canadian manned aircraft carrier, and I decided I wanted to be on that ship. But here I was with the lowest seniority of all the doctors in the Navy, and they all seemed to want to be on it. So how was I going to do it? Well, the only thing I knew to do is I made an appointment with the doctor who and the surgeon, he was a surgeon captain, actually, who was going to make the appointment. And the appointment lasted a very short time. It went like this. He said, how may I help you? I said, I understand, sir, that we're going to get an aircraft carrier. And if you're looking for somebody who really wants to be on that ship, please remember me. He said, thank you. That was it. That was a total conversation. 2 months later, I was appointed to the ship.
Okay. So he said, thank you. That meant I didn't have any meaning to me.
You didn't know what he meant at first.
Oh, no. Okay.
I see you're saying thank you.
I see what
you're saying.
For
coming to see him. Yeah.
What was the name of that aircraft carrier?
It was NABOB, N-A-B-O-B. It was a peculiar ship insofar that Canada didn't take lend-lease, but the British did. And the British had arranged to take five of these escort carriers on lend-lease. And the Canadians wanted to have an experience, so they said they would man the ship, and the British would supply the fleet air component. So our squadron was a very famous one, 852, and they joined us, and we went to war together.
So what happened? You you ended up in the far north with this the very first Canadian aircraft carrier, the NABOB.
NABOB.
And eventually you were hit by a German torpedo.
That's right. Yeah. Oh. It was a surprise.
What was it? What were you doing at that particular time? Do you recall?
Well, we were then with the British Home Fleet. There were 32 ships altogether. And it was a very complicated program. But the thing that we were interested in was the German battleship, the Tirpitz, which was the most powerful battleship that the Germans had ever made, much more so even than the Bismarck. And it was in the Arctic, and it was an ever threat to the Murmansk convoys. It had been damaged by midget submarines the year before, but now is all ready to go again. And the desire was to get rid of that ship. So we were up there with planning to take off our aircraft to take off and bomb the Tirpitz, which was about 100 miles away. Well, what happened was that it was cloudy over the fjord that the Tirpitz was in, so they had to cancel that morning flight, and we got torpedoed about 5 o'clock that afternoon. So that was the end of our attempts to do anything to the
Tirpitz. Well, what did you think at the time? Did you think you were going to die? Did you think that this carrier would sink? I mean, what was going through your mind?
Well, the history of this type of carrier was that if they got torpedoed, they would blow up. And that had happened to all the ships before us except one, the USS Block Island. It had been torpedoed and survived. But ordinarily, they would get, say, 10 or 12 survivors off a crew of 900. So I had been up for about 36 hours, and after it was decided that we were going to fly, I went to my cabin and lay down to get some rest. And it was there. That's where I was when the torpedo hit. It was a big explosion, the loudest thing I've ever heard. I was thrown up out of my bunk. I fortunately came back down, and I had my clothes all laid out beside me in my bed, so I could quickly put them on, and I didn't bother with socks. I just put my shoes on, and of course there was no lighting by this time, so I went to the nearest ladder, and there was a big bunch of people coming up, sailors coming up from the stern of the ship, going up the ladder, and I waited for a while with others, until I went to my action station. I was aware. I was surprised to be alive if we had been torpedoed, but I didn't have any fear. I felt totally alert, totally physics strong, and I waited very calmly with all the others. There was no panic, and I went to my action station, which was on the flight deck. So that's how it all happened. There was no sign of any panic anywhere.
Really?
Yeah.
And how many men were killed?
We only lost 21, but we had quite a number injured.
Uh-huh.
And so I went over after some time, I don't know how long, I went over in a ship's boat to a destroyer that was accompanying us along with the casualties. And so I spent some time there looking after them.
And the aircraft carrier was essentially...
It was finished.
It
had a hole in it 50 feet wide.
Okay.
And it was only by remarkable work by the ship's crew that they were able to save it.
I see. So Canada's only aircraft carrier gone.
That was gone.
Gone.
And then, well, no, there was another one they were which came along behind us, but the same type.
So where did they send you next?
Well, I came home. I got home. We were torpedoed on the August the 22nd, and I got home after several duties end of September. And I went to headquarters in Ottawa, and they asked me what I wanted to do, the guy, the head honcho. And I said I wanted to go to Pensacola and take the American Flight Surgeon's course. I'd had the British one. And they said, we're not interested. So then he said, now what do you want to do? Well, I knew Principal Dallin. I knew I would be the only medical officer there, that I would be plenty busy. It's a lovely place to be. I wasn't going to get back. Wasn't going to be able to get back to sea again. So I chose Charlottetown, Prince Edward Island.
Okay, so you were at on Prince Edward Island. But, I mean, did you know the island well because you were?
I'd only been there once before for one day. It was only a short distance away from where I lived in Nova Scotia. But there was they had to take the ferry to get there, and it was something we never did in those days.
Well, what you did basically was you were a town doctor, even though you were still a naval officer. The Navy told you to, hey, we need doctors. You might as well help the people here in the community.
No, that wasn't quite the way it was.
Okay.
No, what happened was that at that time, the Navy decided they had all the sailors they wanted. Okay, we had a small ship Navy, frigates, corvettes, and some destroyers, everything for working in the North Atlantic, nothing for the Pacific. And so we didn't need anybody anymore. The war in the Atlantic was calming down. There were virtually no German submarines on the Atlantic. There were lots of them up on the Norwegian coast, but not on the Atlantic. And so I was going to be faced with having no recruits to look after. I usually would, ordinarily I'd have 300 or 400 new guys coming in all the time. And I was going to have nothing to do. So, but the commanding officer came along to me one day and said, Doc, there's a place about 25 miles east of here, a farming community with a lot of small villages around that has no doctor for the first time ever. And, you know, it would be great for them if you would open a practice down there. You could go down on Wednesday afternoons and Saturday afternoons, and we'll let you use our panel truck without any cost, and it'll be a great thing for them. And you might have some interesting experiences. Well, I hadn't ever planned to be a country doctor, but I thought, gee, that might be fun, and I might have a lot of experiences I would never otherwise have. So I said, sure, I'll do that, and he was pleased. So the next day, I went down to Eldon, which is the major village, and I interviewed Annie, who lived there in the corner. And I asked her, did she have a room she could rent to me for it to be an office? She said, oh, sure. And she charged me $10 a month for that. And she was a person who knew everybody in the village, of course.
So the Navy was paying your salary to do all of this.
Right.
But you saw lots of civilians, though.
Well, I'd say lots, but it was a significant number. But they were all living in this country area. 25 miles from Charlottetown, the capital, yeah.
And you talked, you found a place to rent from a very interesting woman named Annie.
Yeah, Annie, right.
Who knew about everybody on the island, it seemed like, and had many stories about what people were really like.
Yeah. Well, one thing she said, you have to notice how they dress, because a lot of them, really well-off people would get in their oldest clothes, so they think the doctor would think they're poor. That was one of the stories.
Was that really the case? Was that the case?
I didn't really have any much trouble that way, actually.
Well, you weren't in it for the money anyway. You were getting a salary, didn't really know even what to charge people. You sort of had to, whatever came off the top of your head, right?
I was being paid, and they were by the Navy, and of course these people were paying taxes to support me. But I thought, you know, they would probably appreciate my efforts more if they paid a little bit. So I made a token to $3 for a physical examination, and history and a physical examination. $3, that was it.
Well, Dr. Reed, please hold on a minute, and we need to take a short break. I'm talking to Dr. Charles Reed. His book is This Navy Doctor Came Ashore. He was a longtime professor, a University of Iowa professor of pediatrics. And the book talking about his very interesting time in the Canadian Navy in World War II and adventures as a doctor on Prince Edward Island in the later portion of the war and then a few years after. We'll get back to our conversation in a minute on Talk of Iowa. Talk of Iowa continues. I'm Dennis Reese, talking today to Dr. Charles Reed, Professor Emeritus of Pediatrics at the University of Iowa. He's a dual citizenship, Canada and the U.S., was a Navy doctor in World War II. His memoirs, very interesting about his time aboard, at that time, Canada's only aircraft carrier destroyed by a German submarine. Dr. Reed, we were talking before the break. You we're talking 1944, later in 44. You're not going to
45,
go,
yeah.
You're not going to go back out to sea anymore. And your bosses in the Navy decide you should be a town doctor.
Well, I looked after the naval forces that we still had, and I also looked after the local Army and Air Force people.
Okay, so you were still doctoring to those folks.
I was still in the Navy, totally. Yeah.
Well, then you just learned, Dr. Reed, that I guess I could call it the placebo effect, because you decided or learned, I guess, that people felt better if you gave them some pills to take, and so you ended up giving them multivitamins, and they seemed to feel better. Even.
Well, what really happened was that I would do a nice history and physical, very thorough eye exam and everything, and they didn't seem to be satisfied with what I'd done. So I thought, well, I made an arrangement to buy multivitamin pills in the city, and I sold them to them for $10 for 100. And they're very happy to have this. So I decided that the people who were going to see the doctor wanted to have something to take home.
Did you tell them they were just vitamin pills?
Oh, I just told them multivitamin pills and nothing else. That's all.
That's so amazing that they would be satisfied with – were multivitamins sort of new then?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, you had some really trying experiences in the winter on Prince Edward Island. You might want to tell us this story because it was so interesting. You got a call just before a horrendous blizzard moved through from a man who said his wife had been suffering and needed to be seen right away. And that was about the last thing you wanted to try, because we were talking about how many miles were you from this this village?
Well, it'd be about 28 or 29 miles. It wasn't really a village. It was just sort of a spot in the road.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But that's where the farmhouse was, or where they lived in. Well, what happened was it was a day I thought was going to be a nice afternoon. I had plans for it. And then the telephone rang. And there was this man who I never heard of before saying his wife was ill. Could I come to see her? And I asked, what's wrong? He said, well, she has very sore breasts and she had a baby 9 days before. And I thought to myself, that sounds like a breast abscess to me. So I said, well, why don't you call your doctor? He said, well, I did, But he said to call you because you're young and you have a snowmobile. Well, I knew I was going to have to go. I couldn't. I was a doctor, and it was my job to look after her. But the snowmobile wasn't very effective. It looked like a great. It was one of the early models. It had skis up front, half track, a pear-shaped wooden body, windshield wipers, good heaters, bucket seats in front, and a bar seat in the back. And it looked just wonderful, but it wasn't worth a damn in the snow. Anyway.
You would think a snowmobile would be. But this was, you say, early for a snowmobile.
Oh, yeah, very early. Yeah. They were not tall like they are now. No way.
And
but
so,
anyway.
Well, it was good for a few miles at least, right?
Well, we started off about 12:30. I had a driver who was a Texan. From Mobil Oil Company loaned me this vehicle, and they supplied a driver, and they also supplied somebody to shovel. And we started about 12:30, and at 6 o'clock, we'd gone 15 miles. We'd been stuck, and I have to shovel out all the way. All of us worked at that. Finally, I got to a little country hotel. I called the telephone. I got the telephone up. They showed me how to work this thing. And it was not anything like I'd ever seen before, hanging on the wall. She said that the man had been trying to get in touch with me. I called him. He said his wife was worse. Her temperature's 104 now, and she was in terrible pain. I had to come. I said, well, I can't come in the snowmobile. We won't go any further, but maybe I can get a horse and sleigh. And so pretty soon there was somebody called in the phone, volunteered to take me to 4 miles down to Morrell. Not to Morrell, but... and so I got in the sleigh. I had a raccoon coat on, and I was well dressed and a lot of protection. And the man was very good. I don't know. It was the wind was howling, the snowing hard. You couldn't see anything, and I don't know how he stayed on the road, or if he was on the road, or where he knew where he was. But he managed to get to the country store that we aimed for. It was an amazing experience. It was a very rough ride. The snow was so deep, it was up to the mare's belly. It was a frightful experience.
Well, it's also bitterly cold, you say.
Yeah, bitterly cold. My nose.
Well, you were dressed up.
My nose was running.
Coat.
My nose was running. What do you call it? A nosy day. Yeah, nosy weather.
This was before the time of four-wheel drive vehicles, I suppose.
Yeah.
But the horse got you there. That's absolutely amazing.
Yeah. But the storm was all over. It was an incredibly beautiful night. The stars were unbelievable. The Milky Way was well in sight. And all the fence posts were covered with snow, and the trees all looked like Christmas trees. And finally I got there, and she had multiple breast abscesses, I suspected. And I gave her an anesthetic. Opened and drained, and seven of these abscesses.
Now these breast abscesses, you say in the book that you had no experience, you had not done this procedure before.
I had never done it. The only way I happened to have seen how to do it was I went with my family doctor one Christmas vacation, and he did some up, told me how to do it so it wouldn't cause any problems with the breast with the nipple at all, yeah. And so it was just a great chance, yeah.
One of the things that complicated the story, Dr. Reed, was this woman's husband was a very strange man. And Annie had told you that he hardly ever talked to anybody, and he was so adamant that you get there during this blizzard. But then once you get there, he's sort of scary.
Well... when I was in medical, we used to go out for deliveries, and this happened to a friend of mine, one of my classmates. She went on this delivery with a resident and a nurse, and the husband was drunk, and he was sitting at the table with a revolver, And he would say, nothing better happen to my baby or to my wife. And so this man was sitting in the chair, and he had something in his lap. I remember the story. But she was, the wife was a very nice, lovely lady, and she knew something was growing. She says, tell the man to get out of here and go look after the baby. So he did.
Was she in any danger of losing her life? Had you been?
Yeah, no.
No, she could have.
Yeah, no. Oh, I don't know what happens. I have no experience. Never saw another breast abscess.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you leave. He doesn't even say thank you, and you leave, and you don't talk about the bill. And then some weeks later, you're in your office, and you're thinking, well, he never sent me any money for that for that call. Well, and so you sent him a bill in the mail.
Yeah, I argued. I wonder how much. I didn't charge people very much. I didn't know how much to charge him. And I talked to some of the local doctors. How much? They said about $300. That was an awful lot of money to me. A lot more than I was making in the Navy. And so finally, I sent him a bill for $75. Okay, this is a man that said he'd do anything to have me come. Okay. And about 3 days later, he comes dashing up the steps of my office in the naval barracks, waving this red-faced, waving this bill I sent him, threw it down on the desk in front of me. And he said, I thought you were a real doctor, but you're just another one of those money-grabbing ones.
A money-grabbing doctor.
Money-grabbing doctors, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I was surprised. I didn't expect any reaction like this. But I had such a wonderful experience in the whole thing. I wasn't going to let anything spoil it. And so I just took the bill in hand, and I tore it up and threw it in the waste paper basket and told my secretary, this man is able to leave now.
Yeah. And that pretty much changed his demeanor once he saw you tear that bill in half.
He just left.
Did he ever send you any money? Ever?
No.
And never did?
No, never.
We're just about out of time. Just a couple of minutes left, Dr. Ree. Where did you go from there after the war?
Well, in 1946, I got out of the Navy, and I started a residency at the Children's Hospital in Montreal. And during that time, I got interested in a baby of a diabetic mother and all the problems it had. And that led me on the next year into doing research. I thought maybe it was the adrenal cortex of the baby or the mother was causing this baby to be 9.5 pounds 1 month premature. And I spent the next year and a half doing that. It turned out that these were the first studies on the adrenal cortex of newborn infants. And then I thought, well, maybe it was a human growth hormone that was causing the problem. And so I got a fellowship. I had been doing a fellowship at McGill, and now I got a fellowship at Harvard. And I spent the next 2 years there, 1 year working on trying to develop a method for growth hormone assay, measurement of growth hormone, and the other trying to measure insulin, which also hadn't been done at that time. All of those things were negative. I had 2 years of negative results.
Well, but you've had a lifelong interest in childhood diabetes, right? And
well, what happened to that? I got a job finally when I was 31 years old in Winnipeg. And the first day I was there, they asked me, would I be in charge of the diabetes clinic? Well, I'd been at all these fancy places, and they thought I knew everything, I guess. But the fact was I had never had a lecture on diabetes in children. I knew nothing about the diet for people like that. I'd never even seen a child with diabetes, but I knew one very important thing, that was how to treat the most difficult problem that diabetic kids have, and that is diabetic acidosis, which is what kills people. And I had learned at Harvard how to do that, and I understood that fully, so I was not afraid of it. And so I said, yes, I would do this job. And then what happened was I got talked to the mothers, and they were having lots of problems with the diet. It was a very complicated diet with triple exchange, carbohydrate, protein for protein, and fat for fat. I didn't think I could do it myself.
Yeah.
And anyway, it didn't make any sense to me because you do need insulin to make fat, but not to use it. You only need it for about half of your protein. And most people eat the same amount of protein every day, but you do need insulin for treating the carbohydrate. And so I sat down with a dietitian and made up what I call a constant carbohydrate diet, in which all the exchanges are based on the carbohydrate content. This has become very popular as the basis of all the diets currently in use in the, throughout the world.
So this constant carbohydrate diet, this you invented this, what, early 50s or so?
1951.
And 1951, it's still being used today?
Oh, yeah. Well, everybody uses it now.
Did you ever get any royalty payments or something?
No. We didn't think of royalties in those days.
Oh, my.
Yeah. It's nothing. It's just an idea, you know. It's nothing. Just a simplified way of doing things.
So how did you end up eventually coming to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics?
Well, in the fall of 1953, I was at a meeting in Denver, and I had lunch with the head of the Department of Pediatrics here at Iowa. And at the end of the lunch, he said, if you ever want to leave Winnipeg, please let me know. And so I worked things out that I did want to leave, in order to be, particularly because I wanted to be able to continue my research. And I did that in 1955. I came here in 1954.
As an aside, I think you told me once, Dr. Reed, you've had season tickets to all the Hawkeye football games since 1954. Is that right?
That is correct.
That is an amazing run of season tickets.
Well, that's the thing to do. I mean, I used to go to the practices when Evashevsky was here, and now I'm fortunate one of three old guys that are allowed into practice today.
And Dr. Reed, you, over all of these years since you moved to Iowa, you've made it back every summer to Nova Scotia, Prince Edward Island. You have a cabin or?
Well, no, it's too far away to own a car or a cabin, but we used to drive the 2,000 miles.
2,000 miles.
2,000 yeah. miles to Prince Edward Island, Nova Scotia, every year. Used to do that in 4 days with five children and the cat, Siamese cat.
You brought the cat with you.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Siamese. Cat liked to ride?
Oh, he was great, yeah. It was interesting coming back. He would sleep most all the time. When we crossed the Mississippi, he started getting up a little. And then by the time we were in Iowa City, he was walking around and looking at all at the windows trying to see where we were.
He knew he was home.
He knew he was home, yeah.
I wish we had more time because you talk a lot about lobsters in this book. When you visit, a good friend of yours was a lobster fisherman, and I was hungry for lobster the whole time I was reading this book. Do you love lobster?
Oh, yeah, I like it a lot, yeah.
Is it still as abundant in that area?
It's been more abundant in the last few years than it used to be.
Oh, really?
And that's probably because of the scarcity of cod. Apparently, cod fish like baby lobsters. And now with the scarcity of cod, the lobsters grow up. Yeah. So they're more common than they used to be, yeah.
But also,
I think it's interesting with lobsters. Back in 1944 when I was practicing, and I got paid in lobsters once.
Yeah, you were paid in lobsters, yeah. Right, yeah.
The lobsters were then 25 cents a pound. And I had my bill was $12. I came home with 48 pounds of live lobsters crawling around the trunk of my car.
What do you do with 48 pounds of
lobsters? You boil them the next day.
Boil them the next day.
And then have a party. I'll invite all the neighbors in.
Dr. Reed, thanks so very much. I really enjoyed the book, and talking to you was great. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure.
Dr. Charles Reed is a professor emeritus of pediatrics at the University of Iowa. His new memoir is called This Navy Doctor Came Ashore. Talk of Iowa's executive producer is Jeff Schmidt. I'm Dennis Reese for Charity Nebbe.